So I want to reiterate our thanks for the music this morning. It's just excellent to have so much energy and enthusiasm, not simply the choir, but our band. Yay! Thank you. And to Michael and Laura for a year of music, and I've already sent thanks to you, Kiko, and to Henry, who couldn't be with us this morning, but who's been here often drumming us along this year. It's been excellent. So this taking of summer to switch things up a bit is a curious practice, I think, isn't it? Isn't Sunday still Sunday in the summer? Shouldn't it still be the Sabbath? Well, it is, of course. It is still the Sabbath, still a Sabbath. It's just that for the 8 or 10 weeks of the year, when this part of the world is the most beautiful and beckons us outside, and our schedules are changed by the academic break, we pause. So we will hear what we have to share today, and then see each other again in September, but keep our thoughts on each other in between. And remember that once a week, every couple weeks, there is a time to gather for Vespers, for a quiet time of being together and considering. I mentioned in my description of today a sermon by the Reverend Willie Broderick, who serves the 12th Baptist Church in Roxbury. It was titled, Give Me What You Got. I wonder if any of you had a minute to watch it, which is probably just fine, because then you might be at the 12th Baptist Church right now. He's a powerful preacher. I'm always troubled, he said, living in one of the most historic cities in this nation, founded upon the premises of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We have one of the largest wealth gaps in the country, a have and have not situation. We have a housing crisis, and you will see folk who have nothing, folk who are hurting in one of the most wealthy cities in this country. So during the sermon, he describes an experience of meeting a man named Jimmy, a homeless man sitting on the sidewalk, someone he passed by one morning. And he said to Jimmy, I don't have any cash. I'm really sorry, I don't have any money on me to give you. To which Jimmy replied, that's okay, brother. Just give me what you got. And Reverend Broderick goes on to explain that what he had to offer was prayer. Because in his tradition, in his Baptist faith, he says, if you have nothing else, you have Jesus. And if you have Jesus, you always have something. And at the very least, what you have is prayer. And he goes on to do this amazing series of alliterations, which in the Black Baptist style, about what prayer is. Prayer is invocation, introspection, intercession, he says. Prayer is mediation, meditation, mobilization. Can I tell you what prayer is? Prayer is conviction, concentration, correction. Can I tell you what prayer is? Prayer is dedication, direction, devotion. By the end of it, you're thinking, oh my gosh, I should like be praying right this minute. Sooner or later, he says, you're going to have to get down on your knees. If you have Jesus, you always have something. And to be honest, watching this sermon, and clearly it made me a little envious. I don't have Jesus like that. I don't think I ever did, really. Though maybe that's the difference between the Baptist environment and the Episcopalian environment that I grew up in. Just a little more controlled about our Jesus relationship, to say the least. But it also occurs to me that we as a tradition don't have Jesus like that either. And that's both cultural and theological. I don't even have God exactly like Pastor Broderick does either, to the degree that I can imagine God might live in his life. So I brought a sign, though, to show you what this church used to follow. I found it upstairs in the balcony. It's called the Ames Covenant, right? So our covenant, in the love of truth and in the spirit of Jesus Christ, we unite for the worship of God and the service of man, which some congregations have changed to humankind. So this used to be our practice. The Ames Covenant was written by Charles Gordon Ames in about 1880, and many Unitarian congregations have followed this covenant for many years. Some still do, though not nearly the number. And this congregation, like many, set aside those specifics somewhere in the middle of the 20th century, probably, in deference to a broader path. Do you know when, Julie? 1962? Generally, just generally. So when I heard Reverend Broderick and felt those pangs of envy at his certainty, it made me wonder what we've got to give. What does this tradition offer us by way of spiritual truth here in the 21st century? Comparatives in the realm of religion are always very tricky. What they offer as opposed to what we offer, because it risks putting us on the defensive. And I don't mean for this to be a defense of our tradition today or a justification, but more of a consideration of where we find ourselves at this time and this place in our history. I'm flying out of Boston tomorrow morning to go to Spokane, headed to our General Assembly, which is focused to a large degree this year on who we are. Come to Spokane, it says, to imagine Unitarian Universalism's future. We are at a very interesting place here, again. We are trying, I think, as we have been trying, to move a structure, all of us together, to shift the way we humans meet and greet the mysteries of our living. And it's not simple or short-term work we're about. We are trying to say, I think very broadly, that creeds are not required relative to matters of the spirit or the soul or the heart, that we can, as the Reverend Tandeka suggests, love beyond belief. And yet we're struggling to know just what that means. We can look back and see a series of shifts in our post-merger identity. From an almost reactionary humanist intervention to a more recent examination of language of the spirit, if you will, a recognition that our reliance on intellectual investigation falls a bit short of the needs of our hearts and our souls. And we're very anxious, as a collection of faith communities, to do well by each other and to do well by the world around us, to be responsible for being the change we want to see in the world, even as we kind of get our knickers in a twist over how to express ourselves with any kind of common understanding or vocabulary of meaning. And we forget, just like our hula hoop friends, that we must continue to talk to each other, to wrestle with it. We've set ourselves an Herculean task, I think. And some days it feels like maybe there's not enough there. And yet I often find myself wondering if God, and I invite us to just leave that word out there for a minute, even as we might imagine love, spirit, truth, I wonder if it's trying to find a new way to be present in the world, a new way to be present in each and all of us. And we have this place of opening where maybe we could hear it if we were patient enough. I may have told you before about a teacher training I led one year, probably, I don't know, 10 or 12 or 15 years ago, where I asked the group of people gathered to respond to four questions about their identity. Everyone was asked to share who they are around constructs like nationality and religious affiliation and race and gender. So each of you can imagine for yourselves. These are typically fairly binary identities, we might think, in our current culture. For example, I'm an American, I'm a Unitarian Universalist, I'm white, and I'm a woman. Unless, of course, and I ask you to stretch your imagination, I imagine that perhaps my grandmother was Chinese. So now maybe I'm not just American, I'm Asian American, sort of. Or maybe I was raised in a Reformed temple, so now I belong to a Unitarian Universalist congregation, and I'm wondering about whether I'm Jewish or a Unitarian Universalist. And then, of course, my Asian grandmother, so maybe I'm not exactly white even. Personally, and this is the true part of those examples, I am cisgender, so I identify with the sex I was assigned at birth. But we know it's not always that simple. So these constructs I've asked people to identify for themselves, I then suggested they had to give up one. Somebody came along and changed the world, and you have to give up one of your identities. So which one do you give up first of the things that you have determined about yourself? And we kept turning one in, right? So you're down to three identities, and then you're down to two. And which is the one that you keep for last? And everyone had to share what that was for them individually. There were probably 24 adults in the room, and one held on to her Unitarian Universalist identity the longest. I wonder how you all fell out on that, you know, which was the most important. She's a transgender woman, and she explained it was what saved her life and her marriage and her family, this faith. Her faith community gave her a place to be and to belong. It did not judge her for being who she had been and who she had become. Now, we are not alone as a progressive faith community in welcoming any minority expression of identity. Though we should be proud of the work we have done and continue to do to open our hearts and our minds to the many ways of expression in our lives. And to be fair, this woman, Pamela, made that generosity of spirit more accessible by her own willingness to share her journey during her transition, explaining what she was experiencing, allowing our mistakes, inviting our questions. Her willingness to talk to us enabled us to move that hula hoop together. We don't have Jesus as maybe we used to. It doesn't mean we don't have the example of that encouragement to care for each other, to be connected to something greater than ourselves alone, to recognize our human capacity to do and be for each other in amazing and mysterious ways. There are lines to a poem that's been ringing in my ear, and I haven't been able to locate it. Except as I search for it, it goes. It may never come to light. We have this. We have this to give each other, this tenacious commitment to the journey for real and authentic faith, each in our own fashion, to find what rings true and bring it to light. Like the things we hope to have received, perhaps, from our fathers, a love of creatures, values, and codes of conducts, the do's and don'ts of being human, that but for this place, maybe would not bubble forth. And what we've got to give is the example of relationship, of being willing to talk to each other, to hear each other about how and where things are shifting, how to manage our lives, how to try to heal the world together, loving beyond belief. There was a picture on the website, I think, about General Assembly with a sign that said something about what we're deconstructing on one side and then what we are building together on the other. And it does feel a little bit like that to me, actually, that we are pulling things apart these days, trying to discard what has not served us well as we reconstruct a more powerful way forward. No one knows for sure what that will look like. But I can tell you, I feel unexpectedly hopeful. And I have not always felt that way this year. Right now, I am feeling an energized curiosity and enthusiasm about how we can make room for a new way of receiving love and truth and grace. And I am feeling especially hopeful for this church, for all that we bring to each other and all the ways we are connecting to our community and to the world at large. There is a sense of spirit here and creativity, which is, of course, how the voice of mystery comes to each of us. There is a joyfulness and a wondering, and there is gratitude here. If only the world could have seen you all 3 weeks ago, holding hands and singing together right here in this sanctuary, a blessing beyond words. What we have got to give is a lot, not defined by creed, but offered from our hearts, an authentic search, a powerful compassion, and a willingness to see where that spirit might lead us. So let us take those gifts with us into the world this summer and come back in September with new experiences and new revelations to share.